This is Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham.
Some central Illinois communities have among the highest segregation levels in the nation, in housing and in schools.
The problem is that at some point you have to figure out how to break the mold of how your city is set up.
GLT's Charlie Schlenker talks with Governing Magazine reporters Daniel Volk and Brian Charles about their investigative series and what they learned about Bloomington Normal. Correspondent Colleen Reynolds reports on a panel discussion about poverty in McLean County, and John Norton talks to an Illinois Wesleyan professor about her new book on colorblind racism. All that after a GLT news update. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from GLT listeners. Join the community of news consumers who listen to Sound Ideas and are also willing to support it financially. Learn more about listener-supported radio and GLT at WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. On today's show, an encore presentation of three interviews about race, class, and segregation, and how those issues are playing out in Bloomington Normal. First, some central Illinois communities have among the highest segregation levels in the nation in housing and in schools. Peoria and Springfield, for example. Bloomington Normal has a large racial divide in poverty rates and median household income, also among the most stark in the nation. That's according to Governing Magazine reporters Daniel Volk and Brian Charles, who have done a six-part investigative series looking at a half century of government data. They join us via Skype today. Brian Charles says the lingering segregation is part of the way northern industrial cities developed, with African Americans leaving the South to get away from Jim Crow and to chase industrial jobs. He says they ended up settling in the central core of many cities in the upper Midwest.
One of the things that we did in the series was to not necessarily, and this is often counterintuitive to news, is to say, well, we're going to look for what's necessarily different. We're going to sit there and try to find patterns that repeat themselves often, and then look at the unique conditions on the ground within each one of these cities that allowed those patterns to repeat and kind of manifest themselves over and over again.
Well, if Jim Crow and the Great Migration set this up, and it wasn't until the 70s or so that perhaps banking regulations allowed the pattern to change. Why is it still stuck here? How persistent should we expect the pattern to be? Bloomington Normal has had a lot of growth since then, and yet we're less segregated than Springfield or Peoria, but we're still, you know, fairly segregated.
First of all, the timing of the growth matters. You know, in Bloomington Normal, a lot of the growth in white-collar jobs and what have you has come more recently. So what happened in places like Peoria and Springfield and Rockford is that they kind of hit their peak, and then there wasn't a lot of growth. So what you'll see is outside of the industrial belt that Brian talked about, you'll see more integrated neighborhoods because there's more development just all around, whereas there's not a whole lot of resources to go around in some of these downstate communities. It is very persistent, though, and the problem is that at some point you have to figure out how to break the mold of how your city is set up. So if folks in Peoria, if black people are living on the south side and whites are moving to the north or across the river, you know, those development patterns, you know, where people are chasing, you know, where the greatest new subdivision is, the hottest new school, all that sort of builds on itself. And so people's perceptions build on itself, policy builds on itself. It's really hard to sort of pull back and say, you know, we're just, you know, perpetuating this over and over again.
Well, and also to dovetail on this a little, Dan's point a little bit, and we mentioned like, the 70s when a lot of these laws changed, but look at is the fact that as these African-American families start to arrive, they arrive at a point where we actually start to see industrial output around the country, especially in the industrial belt of the country, already start to decline. And then by the 70s and definitely by the 80s, you see factories start to either close or cut their staffing. So you can change the law at that point, but the amount of wealth that become concentrated by people, you know, who made money and were able to take that those wages and turn them into housing investments and turning them into investments for their kids' college educations, up into the 70s, while African-American families weren't able to do that, by the time they were able to do that, there's not an input of revenue. The jobs are gone. And so there's a couple ways you can kind of peel that. You can look at those African-Americans from the South to some degree as late adopters to the Industrial Revolution. You can also look at it as when they do adopt the patterns of the work patterns of the Industrial Revolution, they are also precluded by function of government policy from taking advantage of the money that they're able to earn within those jobs. And then by the time they're able to actually take advantage through the change in policy, then new jobs are there. So it's almost paradoxical.
Well, let's talk about income, because that is one way in which Bloomington Normal is absolutely typical of the rest of your analysis. The income disparity and the poverty rates for blacks and whites are huge for Bloomington Normal. In fact, well above the national average in terms of income disparity. It's seventh worst or seventh largest discrepancy in the nation. Is that because of State Farm's white-collar, white jobs expansion in the 80s and 90s, and the African-Americans weren't brought along with that? Or is that African-Americans moving to Bloomington Normal from Chicago and taking these service sector jobs? Or what is going on here?
Specifically with the income level, there are a few indicators that we have. You probably know the community, all the ins and outs a little bit better than ours. But I will say that, yes, the growth of State Farm, the growth of Illinois State University, those tended to attract, especially State Farm, higher paying white collar jobs. They didn't have Bloomington Normal compared to other places that we looked at, had a smaller black population to start with. There wasn't as heavy of a manufacturing base compared to a Decatur or Springfield or Rockford. And so they ended up in janitorial jobs and service jobs, even before sort of the economy shifted to a service economy. The places where black families who did, get to Bloomington Normal, most industrial they get is probably the railroads, that type of deal. But there wasn't sort of the same industrial base in Bloomington. So there wasn't that chance to, sort of climb up to the middle class the same way that there would have been in some of these other cities.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. We're talking with Brian Charles and Daniel Volk, reporters for Governing Magazine, about a massive data crunch and a significant series on racial segregation that they have done on mid-sized communities in central Illinois. What should government be considering in policies to affect this dynamic?
We got some response back from some government officials, and I think the first thing that people have to do, and it wasn't something that people were not aware of when we got on the ground, is there needs to be some awareness and some initial conversations about this is a persistent problem. I think one of the things that we often do when we entertain this type of reporting is we look at this repeated pattern over and over and over again, and we don't say, well, somehow government doesn't have a role. But this is a matter of people choosing to move to a particular school district or people making choices about where they're going to live. And yes, there's an element of that that's true, but there's also an element of where government has a role in making sure that it services all of its citizenry. Give me an example, and not necessarily Bloomington example. If you go to Springfield and you go on one side of the town, you see not just beautiful homes, but you see things like curbs and gutters. They're kind of a simple thing one might take for granted. But when you go over to the side of town in which black residents live in, to the east side of town, you don't see curbs or sidewalks. And that's an issue of that's an infrastructure issue. That's an issue in which those roads, because they don't have curbs and sidewalks, are roads that on the edges of them crack more often, need more service, and don't really provide the type of aesthetic that says this is a welcoming place. Those are very subtle things. But those are very important things, and they mark a lot of how much government is interested and investing in your community. Now, you take that out to something like housing, and you say you see places in which one side of the town has homes that are more valuable than the other side of the town. And all those things kind of start to connect. That web starts to come together.
So some of the areas that we looked at were how school districts, especially small school districts, sort of preserve wealth or hoard resources. So in Bloomington, you have an interesting issue where, you know, you've got one school district surrounding another one, and sort of how that, if you're looking at how that would capture wealth as people, especially white wealthy people, move out to the farther areas. We looked at housing policy, so not just, you know, where you put in sidewalks, but, you know, where the big thing is, where is rental property allowed to go? So blacks are twice as more likely to be renting as whites, and that has a lot to do with some historic dynamics. So where you site rental properties, what sort of restrictions are in single family houses, you know, where does the public housing go? Where's the low-income housing tax credit-supported housing go? There's a lot of interlocking policies that matter.
That would suggest it's fairly intractable.
I don't think it's intractable. I think we also, you know, point out instances where there have been progress made. But the issue is that it takes a community effort to sustain it, and it takes an awareness of what you're actually going for. So the convenient thing is, and the easy thing is to do this, the status quo, you really have to sort of put out a sustained effort in order to sort of reverse course.
I mean, you look at right now, there is a movement that is bubbling up in some cities around the country to upzone cities. I mean, if you were to have that in a lot of cities, you'd have the opportunity to build more rental and more affordable housing intermixed among cities and potentially in metro areas. And that would give families the opportunity to go to places to get their kids into better schools and to do things to improve their position in life. I mean, that would be a government policy that one could pursue that would integrate your community a little bit better. And that's not something that's not possible. There's quite a few communities around this country that are considering it at this point.
There is also, apart from these institutional factors, there are cultural factors as well. Research done more than 10 years ago at Illinois Wesleyan University suggested that also significantly important in the choice of where to live, along with income and the affordable housing patterns that you've laid out, is a cultural sensibility that people tend to move closer to people who think like they do, who look like they do. We've seen that in the South Asian community, the Indian community in Bloomington Normal, and you allude to it in your series when you've noted that an influx of African Americans have tended to move adjacent to the traditional African American neighborhoods. How do you get around that self-segregation?
I think we want to be careful in how we talk about that too, because a lot of the self-segregation ends up being on whites. So other research, particularly at the University of Illinois, Chicago, has looked at sort of what social networks and sort of how blacks and whites perceive this differently. So basically what it comes down to is blacks are more comfortable with diversity than whites. And at some point, you know, the threshold of, you know, how many whites can be in the community for it to be diverse versus how many blacks is different among blacks and whites. You know, there's a tipping point at some point, and I think there's the researchers haven't figured out exactly where that is, but if a neighborhood gets too black, then whites flee. On the other hand, you know, there are black families that are looking for an integrated, you know, neighborhood where they're not necessarily, they don't want to be vastly outnumbered, but they also don't want a, you know, 100% black neighborhood. So there are people that like to be near their family, near their church, near their other sorts of, you know, businesses. But I think that's not the entire story. I think a lot of what you need to be looking at is, you know, where, what are whites, how are they responding to diversity in their communities, and what are they comfortable with? Because they're in the majority, they have more of the resources, and sort of they're driving a lot of these development patterns.
That gets us back to community will and political will then. Are whites sufficiently aware of the pernicious effects of these patterns to want to change them?
honestly, I think that a lot of whites will spend most of their time in white neighborhoods, and blacks will spend a significant amount of time in black neighborhoods. And the segregation is, I mean, one of the problems is that it's hard to get your head around if you're not sort of actively, you know, sort of challenging it. But it is possible to be in a, you know, majority white community and see very little of the majority black neighborhoods. You're not thinking about the challenges that having that separation, you know, has on investment, you know, infrastructure or schools or whatever it is. So I think it is hard, and that's why it needs to be something that, you know, local officials, journalists, you know, other thought leaders need to be cognizant of and thinking about, because otherwise it's very easy to get comfortable in how the way things are.
Also affecting the ability of sustained governments to sustain political will is community resources. And many mid-sized communities in Illinois and really throughout the nation are seeing flat to falling sales tax bases that would help nudge the needle on this. They're seeing a number of things that limit the ability of government to do much at all beyond basic core services. Do you see that as a significant hurdle, or is there a workaround?
It is a hurdle, but it's not an insurmountable one. I mean, the thing is, if you go to, you know, Bloomington, if you go to Peoria, if you go to Springfield and Rockford, there are booming areas. There are places where investment is coming in. There are resources available. So, you know, I mean, a lot of it is sort of how do you harness those resources? How do you, you know, some of it, you know, you talk about political, is like, you know, is that on the wrong side of a boundary? You know, how do we bring it on our side of, you know, like political, like, you know, on a suburb rather than the city and a different school district, that kind of deal. Those are problems that can be addressed. But I mean, even in areas that are legitimately struggling with their budgets, there are still resources available. It's a matter of trying to figure out how to get the right incentives and how to get people to harness the resources that are available. I mean, there are nice, comfortable places in all these communities that we covered.
Brian, I know that your series has caused links to it to fly fast and furious around this community, and I believe in Springfield and Peoria as well. Obviously, a conversation starter is what journalists hope for. What else do you hope comes out of this big effort here?
You know, yes, the conversation is important, but I think the other thing is that there's an opportunity for some of these communities to start to try to address these situations and create potential solutions for this that maybe other communities could follow, right? I mean, at heart, at the end of this, the idea that these are communities is kind of the central principle, right? And if you have a community, there's got to be some level of everybody coming together to work on problems together. There may be some level of self-segregation, as you may say, and that may happen across cultural boundaries. But in the end, Bloomington, Rockford, Springfield, Peoria, they have some common issues, and everyone has kind of an interest in solving those problems. And you can't do that if the community is chopped up and divided along lines of race, especially when you have folks on one side of that line that have far less resources than folks on the other side of that dividing line. I don't know if you took race out of this and this was purely a matter of just people being poor in a particular part of the city and there wasn't a racial division. I don't know if people would allow the situation to exist is what I would say. You know, I think people would say, well, that's part of our community and we need to fix that. And so sometimes what happens when we include race is there may not be as much of an interest in trying to address the issue. And I think the reporting actually, to some degree, shows that. So what I would hope for in this is that, yes, the conversations, which talking to policymakers who've responded since those conversations are happening, but what I would hope is that those conversations lead to some folks thinking about a myriad of policies that would address everything from housing segregation to school segregation to the way fines, fees, and law enforcement affect the African-American community in those towns.
Ryan Charles and Daniel Vock are reporters for Governing Magazine. They have done a series looking at a half century of data in a big analysis of segregation patterns in central Illinois communities. Gentlemen, a big achievement. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
I'm Charlie Schlenker. This is Sound Ideas.
Up next, what those on the front lines say about poverty trends in McLean County. This is Sound Ideas.
Here are the top NPR and local GLT news stories, handpicked just for you, right now on the NPR One app. Listen to GLT newscasts and our biggest stories on demand, or settle in for some podcast listening. You can even customize your favorite types of stories. NPR One has it all. Think Spotify or Pandora for news. This is GLT.
And this is Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. The McLean County poverty rate of 13.6% seems a bit low to people who look at such things in the community. The loss of manufacturing jobs, lack of affordable housing, cuts to social service agency funding, and high rates of children that qualify for free and reduced lunches back up that gut feeling expressed by people at a recent League of Women Voters panel discussion on poverty. GLT correspondent Colleen Reynolds reports.
The average person making minimum wage in McLean County would have to work 76 hours a week to be able to afford a two-bedroom apartment here, according to a Heartland Alliance 2018 poverty report. 26% of all McLean County households are considered rent burdened. That's slightly higher than the statewide average. But housing costs are only part of the problem. There are many factors driving residents into poverty. For Starla Hayes, it began when her husband divorced her after 22 years of marriage.
She had three kids. I couldn't deal with getting divorced, so I bailed. I went to drugs and alcohol, and then I came back. I've been back, 8 years now? In 4 years in Mayor's Manor. So my kids are let me back in their lives, but it was a struggle. I mean, when you go down that, the drugs and the alcohol, that's what hurt you. It took my kids a long time to forgive me, and they do now. And I'm grateful for that. And I'm so grateful for Mayor's Manor. And Tasha, Senna, Tony, you guys have been amazing. If it wasn't for you, I don't know where I'd be.
Located at the southwest edge of downtown Bloomington, Mayor's Manor has 26 efficiency apartments that provide supportive living for previously homeless single adults. It has been almost at capacity since it opened 8 years ago. Director Tasha Davis of Mid-Central Community Action grew up in Chicago public housing and lived at Sunnyside in Bloomington.
I know what it feels like to be impoverished. Both of my parents work. My mom worked two jobs, and my dad was in the household, but we were still in poverty. And sometimes we can see that right now in the faces of the children that live in McLean County, because we have the working poor. We have individuals that are working two jobs trying to make ends meet, and they're not making it.
Gina Campbell falls into that category. She graduated from Illinois State University with a bachelor's degree, but started her first job at $10 an hour and had inadequate health insurance. As a type 1 diabetic, Campbell often had to choose between medications costing close to $1,200 a month and buying groceries.
So there just wasn't a sufficient amount of food or drink for me to intake to increase my blood sugar, which is a completely panic-inducing situation. There's a lot of fear. It's a huge fear component that goes into poverty. Your resources aren't reliable. Your support system isn't reliable. You're basically out there stranded on an island just trying to get by with very little. So I had to consume like year-old snow cone syrup. Like that's where I was at personally. You know, at that point I was like, I can't live like this. I'm working hard, but this, I can't do this. So I sought out another job, and I sought out a job specifically that would allow me to access government benefits, because I couldn't, if I made a couple dollars more, wasn't going to be enough. I couldn't make, you know, $20 more. That's not really realistic based on the experience or my education. So I obtained a job that paid less so that I could have access to those resources, which ultimately did not make the situation completely better. I don't think that this is often talked about, but like SNAP dollars, you're not given a sufficient amount. It's not enough. It's not enough, and it is I won't go into the details about why I think that is, but it was never enough.
Campbell quotes research by an ISU graduate student showing 45% of college students nationally face some type of food insecurity. Campbell is now working towards a master's degree and, with help from Normal Township Supervisor Sarah Grammer, started the School Street Food Pantry that operates out of First United Methodist Church in Normal. She still struggles due to a lack of a livable wage combined with internship requirements and time spent on rigorous coursework. Many churches offer helping hands. Jana Vernon is part of the ministry at Abundant Life Church in the heart of downtown Bloomington that ministers to people living on the margins every day. A few years ago, while living in another city, Vernon was homeless herself for a while. She says poverty dramatically changes a person's life. She said being homeless makes people so vulnerable they're willing to sacrifice values and often make poor choices. Vernon says shame associated with poverty can be isolating as friends and a previous life slip away.
Your social group might come alongside you for a little while, but if you don't get your situation resolved, eventually that kind of wanes, and then you find yourself not as involved with that same social group, and you probably end up hanging out with people who maybe live more kind of like in the seedy side of society or the underbelly of society. People will come together who share those same struggles because they have an altruistic bond and they can kind of relate and feel comfortable with each other because they don't have to confront the fact that they don't have the financial resources to do the things that others are doing. They can all kind of like share in their sort of like being down on their luck experience together. So it affects your life on a number of levels, and it can be even more difficult to come out of it because sometimes even with just getting jobs and stuff, you need resources even just to get a job, whether it's the transportation or you need to buy clothes to wear to work or help with resume building and stuff like that. Or if it's even just that you don't have a home address, there are certain things that you're going to have to miss out on just because you don't have a mailing address. Mm-hmm. So it becomes a pretty precarious situation. And if there isn't some kind of intervention that happens sooner than later, it does become something that has a pretty serious negative impact on public health.
I'm assuming you're talking about yourself, your experience?
That has been, some of it's been my experience personally, yes. But I've also seen that become the experience with some of the women I've ministered to and stuff like that. They have a long road ahead of them as far as regaining a sense of autonomy and self-efficacy and having the ability to just be confident that they can take care of themselves. It's definitely an uphill battle.
Vernon was asked about what contributes to poverty. She says trauma can have a crippling effect.
I think sometimes it can also be that if you have some kind of underlying mental illness, that can affect your ability to work and to function. And if you don't get treatment for that or the kind of help that you need, it can be a downward spiral and you can find yourself without support or a job. Or even if you're in a relationship that is abusive, there's a controlling element that prevents you from necessarily always being able to be kind of transparent about your life. You spend a lot of time hiding things when you're in situations like that because it's embarrassing. And so there's just a number of factors that can play into losing employment and ultimately being homeless or on the streets.
Meanwhile, Lisa Herzig says she suffered trauma at age 13 when her mother went to prison and Lisa went to foster care.
I ended up getting into one abusive relationship after another because at that point in my life, that was all I knew.
Herzig wound up at the YWCA's Labyrinth House.
I suffered from a lot of mental illness from it all, being traumatized through this all, and it affected my life a lot, and I stayed in certain situations because I had no choice. I had no other place to go. I would have been homeless without anything to eat, not knowing where to go at all. So it forced me to be stuck in a lot of situations that were not meant for me, and which ultimately led to my own incarceration, and which, you know, thank the Lord, it wasn't all that long, but it was long enough to, I lost my job. The job that I had was you can't have a criminal record and still do this job. So I lost my job. I lost my home, which made me lose my car. Losing my car, I had no way to get to anything. It really put me down. I had nothing, nobody. And that's when I found the Labyrinth. I was actually in a domestic violence shelter after having my neck fractured. And I was in the shelter and I came to the Labyrinth, and that's when they approved me for the program, and I was then put on a waiting list. And like she said, I've been there since July, and programs like this are the best in the world. They really are. I mean, they help with so much that it's, I don't even know how to say thank you sometimes. I mean, I really don't. I would still probably be in that same abusive relationship. I would still probably be doing some of the things that I was doing. But because of programs like this, I was able to get out and I was able to make something of my life.
Kara Ault directs the Labyrinth program for women who've been in prison or jail and who need a variety of support, including transitional housing, job coaching, and transportation.
For anyone in the transitional living program, they do have to attend some groups to be in the program, and then outreach is invited as well. But we do things like communication skills, anger management, healthy relationships, and trauma recovery, and we host an NA meeting every week as well, and also self-care. So we kind of try to touch on all the topics there. And then we do case management. So I say we will do anything that they need help with, and if we can't, we will guide them to someone who can. So, you know, we try to do our best all around. And just with transitional living, they can live with us for up to 2 years.
Pat Turner also grew up in poverty. She says she wanted to be a part of the solution, even as others reached out to help her.
Thank goodness there were family church members that reached out and brought food to my house. Now, what they didn't know at the time was that God had given me a vision that I would run a food program. And when I saw them there at my door, I went, that's what I was supposed to be doing. And I actually took those bags of groceries that they shared. We kept one for our family, and we started the Center for Hope food pantry with the second one. I share that story because it's important that we understand that poverty must not be seen as just a problem to be solved. There are quality people who are facing poverty, who are challenged.
Turner says poverty often compounds simple problems such as a slight illness. Without sick days or money to cover unexpected child care, low-income people easily lose jobs. Turner says helping those suffering from the effects of poverty is important. Equally, if not more important, Turner says, is addressing systematic issues that cause poverty, including racism, sexism, and pay inequality. More affordable housing could also help. According to a McLean County Regional Planning Commission study, rent subsidies are available to fewer than 1,500 of the 8,000 households who need help. I'm Colleen Reynolds.
The League of Women Voters of McLean County will have another forum February 26th addressing how McLean County can overcome its shortage of affordable housing. This is Sound Ideas.
You know, mornings can define the rest of your entire day. Find $5 you forgot about in your pocket. It's going to be a good day. Spill your coffee all over yourself. Probably going to be a bad one. But when you begin your day with Morning Edition, you start fully awake with the latest and most important news to prepare you for whatever comes next. Take control of your day. Listen to Morning Edition from NPR News.
I'm GLT Morning Edition host John Norton. Join me weekdays from 4 to 9 a.m. on GLT.
The news you need when you want it. That's what you'll find at our website, WGLT.org. The latest local news stories, plus reports from Springfield, Washington, and around the world. You can also subscribe to our podcast and catch up on your favorite GLT features, from GLT's Grow to John Norton's music interviews and everything in between. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
And this is Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. An Illinois Wesleyan University professor of sociology says fighting against racism requires more than simply ignoring race. Megan Burke's latest book, Colorblind Racism, argues that the well-intentioned trend of colorblindness, or disregarding the importance of an individual's race, does not in fact lead to racial equality. GLT's John Norton caught up with Burke to discuss how colorblind racism manifests itself in American society.
The way I like to talk about colorblind racism is that it reflects a belief that racism is a thing of the past, and that any way that we might understand what is clearly demonstrated, perpetual, persistent racial inequality in the United States is either explained by individual merits or lack thereof, or what I always say we imagine to be true about our own or each other's cultures. So the colorblind aspect is in an unwillingness to really grapple with the ongoing realities of racism, and that itself can become racist because it helps us to continue to participate in those systems that perpetuate racial inequality.
You hinted at individualism. That is key to this, right?
Absolutely.
This country is built on rugged individualism, mm-hmm. and everybody looks at themselves, at least white people historically, as if I work hard enough, I can do anything.
That's right.
Within reason. How does that factor into colorblind racism?
I think it factors in a number of ways. The first is that, and I think this is really important for us to recognize, that is a cherished ideal. It would be a beautiful society where the only thing that mattered really was our own merit, our own talent, our own hard work. I think that's part of the reason that that is so important to us culturally as Americans. I think for many white folks, it's easy for us to assume that that is indeed all that is going on in shaping our successes or our lack thereof. What we're less able to see for a whole variety of reasons are the ongoing realities of racial privileges and the ways that a long history of overt and covert racism has shaped society in a way where individualism is simply not the only way that we can understand how and why we still have segregated communities, how and why there are persistent disparities in just about every measure of social outcomes in the United States. So it's, I think it's an important ideal for us, and we don't want to let that go in a way. But when we take that as the only sort of common sense way to understand how and why we still have these very real problems, we get stuck. And colorblind racism, I think, reflects that way of thinking.
Was it the civil rights movement itself that we went from covert or overt to covert racism?
Yeah, that's often seen as a turning point in the way that we tend to talk and think about race in the United States. And in some ways, that's very understandable. I mean, it was the collective work of decades of struggle in the civil rights movement that helps us to eradicate some of the formal, perfectly legal, de jure forms of racism, for example, that made it perfectly legal to discriminate in housing and public spaces and all of those kinds of things. So the civil rights movement, the freedom movement, as it was often known at the time, was crucial in eradicating some of that availability for us to perpetuate formal overt racism. I think what we have done is assumed that that was all that was necessary and that that might alone kind of get us back to a level playing field. And we know, of course, that that's simply not the case.
There were overt forms of racism before the civil rights movement, but you argue in your book that there were definitely covert or colorblind racism itself, even if it was undefined at the time, way before the civil rights movement as well, right?
That's right. And I think that that's sometimes what our scholarship and our discourse around it has also missed. So colorblind racism is sometimes referred to as the new racism, but there were examples of colorblind racism being used in the 1800s and certainly for much of the 1900s, even up to the civil rights movement.
Can you give an example from the 1800s?
Yeah, absolutely. So this isn't exactly the 1800s, but an example I often use with my students is our 1924 Immigration Act, where we actually went to census data from the 1800s and made a law that said that we were going to restrict immigration to the United States based on a flat percentage, 2%, of any of the immigrants that were in the country in the 1880 census. That looks fair on the surface.
Well, that's
right?
40 years difference.
Well, exactly. And I think that what makes that colorblind racism is that by the 1920s, there was such extreme anxiety about certain groups of immigrants, in particular Asians, and those from Southern and Eastern Europe. In the 1880 census, we had far higher numbers of Western and Northern European immigrants. And so what that did, by allowing an allegedly even percentage of immigrants in a quote-unquote colorblind fashion, was really help us to institutionalize racial preferences for immigrants from Northern and Western Europe.
And I can think of a housing incident where both covert and overt were being used around the same time, right? Housing covenants and neighborhood associations, or neighborhoods that didn't allow people of color, especially black people, into the neighborhood on the argument that it lowered property values, right? So it wasn't a color argument.
Yes, that's a great example. So when we say, well, it's not that I'm racist, it's just that I want to protect my property values, or it's not that I'm racist, I'm just fearful of X, Y, or Z. That is allowing us to use what is sort of a classic line of colorblind racism, which is to take anything but race, anything but racism path to trying to understand or explain, or as I often say, explain away the realities of racism, either past or present.
Dr. Megan Burke, Associate Professor of Sociology at Illinois Wesleyan University, our guest here on GLT Sound Ideas. We're talking about her new book, Colorblind Racism. I'm John Norton. You heavily reference Eduardo Bonilla Silva in your book, his 2000 book, Racism Without Racists, Colorblind Racism and the Persistence of Racial Inequality in America.
That's an academic title for you.
Okay. Well, he identified four central frames for identifying colorblind racism that you outlined in here as well. Can you briefly explain those four frames and why they're important?
Yeah, I'll start with why they're important. I think they're important because they are ways that we have learned to interpret racial phenomena in the United States, and they reflect very common kinds of discourse, so the way that we talk and think about race in the United States. And so think about to the extent to which you hear these show up in our understandings of race and the way that people talk about it. The first is what is called naturalization. And what that tends to do is to say, well, it's only natural. This tends to happen most often with segregation. And so we say, well, it's only natural that, let's say, Asian immigrants want to live near other Asian immigrants, and that's why we have a Chinatown. Now, it's true that immigrant communities do form important networks to help acclimate newcomers and to share resources and to maintain cultural identity and all of that kind of thing. But what that even misses is the realities of extreme racism against Asians, past and present, certainly in the past, that made it so that that was the only option. So it ignores segregation. Another is called abstract liberalism, and it's just as we were talking about. It's that strong belief that we already have a fair and equal society and an even playing field, and on that basis says that it really must just then be the fault or the credit of the individual that may explain individual success or failures.
Okay.
The third is what I think most strongly echoes overt forms of racism from the past, but it still tends to do so in a colorblind way, and that is called cultural racism. So that's us saying, you know, again, using the example of Asians, that, you know, Asian culture somehow just inherently values and teaches their kids to value education and hard work. It says that, you know, whites often do the same, and it uses really tired pretty racist tropes about black Americans, for example, to explain relative lack of attainment in education, employment, just about every measure. So it blames culture or credits culture without, again, seeing the realities of structural, institutional racism and ongoing bias. The fourth does what they all do, but it does so a little bit more directly. It's the minimization of racism. And so that lets us say, well, it's not race, it's social class, or, you know, it's not racism, we simply have a preference for this type of admissions criteria or whatever it might be in an institutional setting. And so it does so directly. It says, I'm not a racist, the past is the past, those kinds of things.
I want to ask you about a couple of other institutions where especially colorblind racism still exists, and it once surprised me was healthcare.
Mm-hmm.
How does colorblind racism manifest itself in healthcare?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, you've always got these two ends of it. One is unevenness in availability to seek quality care and to receive it. So do you have a job that carries benefits that allow you to access health? So there's that structural institutional side of things. There's also, of course, plenty of well-meaning medical practitioners who still carry assumptions about even things like pain tolerance. There's been studies that indicate that doctors and nurses and other health professionals may assume that black folks have a higher pain threshold and so may be less likely to trust their own narratives about their bodies and the pain that they're experiencing. It can often carry with it assumptions about behaviors that may signal healthy or unhealthy behaviors and willingness to be able to provide certain kinds of care in response to that. And so it really is pervasive, and that's a depressing thing to recognize, but that's exactly the point, is we have to be able to sit with those uncomfortable truths in order to move forward.
Policing as an institution has certainly gotten a lot of attention in the last 4 or 5 years, especially whether you want to call it colorblind racism or just blatant racism.
Sure.
Was the killing of Michael Brown in 2014 in Ferguson, was that a turning point as far as education, as far as awareness, maybe for white people?
You know, I haven't looked at that empirically, but I think, again, anecdotally, and the way that I'm hearing conversations begin to shift and change around me, as I'm sure you have as well, I do think it has been. I mean, I think for communities of color, it was nothing new. There does come a breaking point, and we have seen movements throughout history that respond to that kind of breaking point. The killing of Emmett Till, of course, is a great example of that as well, that launched the civil rights movement. So I do think that there is a rising awareness among, for, as you say, and I think this is correct, many white folks to really have to look hard at the realities of bias and discrimination and the way that that manifests in life or death situations like use of force among police officers. And so I think that the conversation in some ways is beginning to change, but I still think that we lack some of the tools to really meaningfully handle that because we're so heavily socialized, these colorblind ways of thinking and talking about race.
This is GLT Sound Ideas. I'm John Norton with Dr. Megan Burke, Illinois Wesleyan University Professor of Sociology. We talked about rugged individualism, and we talked about structural racism and how they, you know, intersect, so to speak. But your research showed that, especially maybe in the last few years, Black people, especially, you know, maybe 3/4, if I'm getting the number right, believe that there is structural racism and that it's still a problem. But even white people, like over 50% of white people now, are thinking there is a problem. Yet when you boil it down, even Black people still cling to the rugged individualism that if something goes wrong, maybe because they didn't work hard enough.
Right.
Or, right, could you expand on that a little bit?
Yeah, and it's
because they don't go together.
That's right, and it's such complicated territory. But I think it, on a basic level, it simply reflects the fact that we share a culture, that we share a society, that we, by and large, consume the same media, that even as partisanly divided as we are today, that both major political parties still draw on the same kind of discourse. And so we all learn to internalize that blame. We all also must still put forth our best foot. So it's not as though an emphasis on structural and institutional racism means that individuals don't have to work hard and don't have to utilize their talent and don't have to do everything possible. That, in a way, becomes all the more important, actually, for those who are constrained by systems of racism. And so there is a strong effort among really all communities, but particularly within marginalized communities, to teach each other that, and at the same time to internalize that as the only answer, because it is what is so predominant in our culture. And so I think that it's actually less of a contradiction than it might sound. It just indicates that we're in the same culture, we're in the same society, and yet we're up against different constraints.
If I'm a white person, what is the argument that even though I benefit from racism, I need to change the system? Other than a moral argument, right? Other than a religious argument, is there an economic argument that white people should care that white privilege is a thing in our country?
Well, absolutely. I mean, I think that in some ways it echoes the idea that a rising tide raises all ships. I know that's a little bit of a tired trope and it doesn't work perfectly. But, you know, if we were to really struggle for a society that was really fair for all and that really attended to the very real problems at the margins, then that's only going to further help everyone.
How do you get someone who, as I kind of said earlier, how do you get someone who just doesn't care that race still matters because they're in the majority and it doesn't really, to them, affect them?
You know, that's a great question. In some ways, I'm spoiled. When I work with students, I have, you know, the shortest amount of time I have is 3 full days to work with students. And most often I have 15 weeks in a semester. You know, I write books about this that I get to spend years on and hoping that someone will take the time to pick it up and read it. You know, I think in passing conversations, it's a little bit more challenging. And I think you also signal what has also been called racial apathy, which is related but somewhat different. So apathy says, I don't care. This doesn't affect me. But I think that's getting to be a harder and harder position to hold as movements do the good work of helping us recognize the realities of ongoing racism and bias, seeing it as a life or death matter, as the Black Lives Matter movement, for example, has done in movements long before it also have. You know, I think we have to be able to recognize people's shared humanity and the common goals that I think many of us have across the political spectrum, and to speak to people's best selves and the person that they want and need to be, to have good careers, to forge meaningful relationships in their families and their communities. And so I actually remain pretty hopeful, but this is what makes society complicated, is that that's never going to be uniform.
That's Megan Burke, professor of sociology at Illinois Wesleyan University, speaking with GLT's John Norton about her new book, Colorblind Racism. There's a community event planned related to the book at the Normal Public Library on April 1st. It's co-sponsored by Not in Our Town and Black Lives Matter Book Club. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas and WGLT Normal. WGLT.org is where you can find Sound Ideas interviews and stories with help today from Charlie Schlenker, Colleen Reynolds, and John Norton. I'm Ryan Denham. You can subscribe to Sound Ideas on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, or NPR One. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.